from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Welcome to Rated LGBT Radio and this installment. I have always bragged to you guys that we have great shows lined up for you, and I think we have delivered on that promise time and time again. Well, today we don't just have a great show. We have a really great show for you. There are celebrities on the landscape who claim to be icons. Paris Hilton is out with a new CD, and it's all about her being an icon. So she's a self-declared icon. And then there are people who, in the LGBTQ world, that a few LGBTQ people buy their hit records, and they're declared icons. Well, today, not only do we have two gentlemen who, in their own right, could claim the title icons, but more importantly, they're really the icon makers. I mean, the words and thoughts and intentions that have come out of a lot of celebrities have come through the two guests that I have waiting for us today. And those two people are Martin Lewis, who is a multifaceted player in the sphere of arts and entertainment. He has a five-decade history working in music, comedy, film, stage, TV, radio, books, and he has been an absolute influence on how a lot of those have been marketed and brought to the public. He's been a cultural alchemist with many of the leading musicians and comedic artists and helping inspire them and integrating into working altruistically. He's a huge backer and activist with Amnesty International. In fact, he has been said to be the straight man who got Amnesty International to include LGBTQ rights as part of its mantle and as part of its mission. He has worked with celebrities that range from Boy George, Elton John, George Michael, Neil Patrick Harris, Billie Jean King, Martina Navratilova, Alan Cummings, and more. And most importantly, and really pertinent to today's show, he is seen as one of the major experts on the Beatles and on Brian Epstein, who was the original manager of the Beatles. And that is, Brian is actually going to be one of our subjects of the show. Before I talk about that, though, our other guest is also another icon maker, Bruce Vilanch. Bruce, you might have seen him recently on the documentary Outstanding, which was a documentary about the comedy revolution of LGBTQ artists across the board and their influences. But Bruce is somebody you may not, well, you've probably seen him in front of the cameras, but behind the cameras, the man to know. He is the head of the writers for the Academy Awards. He's won two Emmys for Academy Awards shows. You know, he has also been a forerunner of comedy going back to many decades, skit comedy, variety show comedy. He's been around it all, for it all. He's written jokes for Bette Midler, Elizabeth Taylor, Lily Tomlin, and he's even written for the Brady Bunch. Anyway, that has been Bruce. So, and we're going to be talking about, like I said, Brian Epstein, who it has been said, if there wasn't a Brian Epstein, there wouldn't be a Beatles. you would not have ever heard of the Beatles. You wouldn't be listening to their music. You wouldn't have had their cultural influence without Brian Epstein. So between Brian Epstein, Martin Lewis, and Bruce Vilanch, if American culture was a Jenga game and you removed those three people out of the stack of Jenga game, I guarantee you it would topple. That is how wide and deep their influence has been. More to the point, or very specifically to the point, one of the things that is behind our conversation is actually an event that is going to be happening Friday, August 23rd. It will mark the 60th anniversary of the Beatles' landmark first appearance in Los Angeles in 1964. And marking that debut at the same time and the same date as the event 60 years ago, Martin will be giving a TED-style talk that will be about the Beatles, and it is called The Greatest Beatles Story Never Told. And it will tell their untold story, that how they went from unknown to absolutely thrilling not only the United States, but the world, and really being a foundation for so much of our musical culture. So that's what we have waiting for you. Can't wait to get to it. Before I bring the gentleman on, though, I do want to bring on Brody Levesque. Brody is the former editor of the Los Angeles Blade magazine and has at least one important story that he wants to share with us, kick things off. Brody, welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Yeah, I do. From the Sarasota Herald Tribune Metro reporter and someone I know, Stephen Walker, comes a story from the New College of Florida, which initially was a liberal arts institution in Sarasota, and Governor Ron DeSantis literally turned its board into a complete, what he called, anti-woke board, and they have played havoc like he's done in most of the state's university and colleges with programs and offerings and things like that. The New College of Florida, however, he specifically targeted because he seriously wanted a way to say, we're getting rid of the progressive woke nonsense, the DEI and all of that. So journalist Stephen Walker writes today in the Herald Tribune that hundreds of library books, including many on LGBTQ topics and religious studies, were headed to a landfill. And what the college did, I particularly find onerous. They parked a dumpster in front of the Jane Bancroft Cook Library on the campus, and then they dumped the books and collections from the now-defunct Gender and Diversity Center and the library on those very subjects into the dumpster. Video was captured on social media showing the truck picking up the dumpster, driving away with the books, and this was done before any of the students that attend that college were afforded an opportunity to purchase the books that were being obviously tossed out of the college's library collection. Now, on video, some of the discarded books included the following titles: Nine and Counting, The Women of the Senate, The War of the Worlds, When I Knew, which is a collection of stories from LGBTQ people recounting when they knew they were gay. A spokesperson for the college, Nathan March, acknowledged to the Herald Tribune the request for comment, but didn't bother providing one. There were a few people that is on the board of trustees who completely, totally disagreed with DeSantis and DeSantis appointees. She did speak to the Herald Tribune. She's one of the few representatives of the faculty on the board. Her name is Professor Amy Reed. And this is what she said to the Herald Tribune. They take the trees, and people had a service to recognize the lots of those trees. I want to do that for books because books are what matter. She further added, when you throw away books, you also throw away democracy. And then she had had a fourth-year student at the college look into it. And, you know, officials were asked whether those books could be donated. And under a state law in Florida, the college isn't allowed to donate books purchased with state funds, which, quite frankly, is a rather lame excuse. I'm sure there's probably, excuse me, a bureaucratic way around that, but they weren't working to do anything with that. And the reason I'm bringing this particular story up is because of one thing. The latest polling we're getting in the 2024 election run now has the vice president out in front of the former president. It's still a very narrow race, but the vice president's numbers are going up. And the more her numbers are going up, the more that the vice president candidate and the Republicans, J.D. Vance and Trump, keep, you know, catering and kowtowing to the very elements of the people, okay, that were directly responsible for the rhetoric and directly responsible for people like Ron DeSantis taking office, have no problem throwing away books, just as the professor pointed out, like throwing away democracy. This story goes to the heart of why this election is so important. This story goes to the heart of why we need people out there voting, not only just within the queer community, but our allies as well. You know, folks, this is no lie. This is the seminal moment and event, okay, in American contemporary history. And it really does, as President Biden has said, as the vice president has said, and as a reporter, I can tell you, this comes down to democracy. Does America want to embrace democracy, or does it want to slide into an authoritarian, fascist-style state? When right. you've got universities and boards and people willing to throw away books because they don't agree with the books or the content, that is censorship, and that's exactly authoritarian, and that's exactly what we need to prevent. Well, again, it's an important election.
But Brody, it's even worse than that, because they're not just throwing books about that away that are books on subjects of which they don't agree. They're throwing away books to throw away the people the books are about. I mean, this is like, you know, they want to erase women. Good luck with that. They want to erase gay people. They certainly want to erase trans people. And, you know, anything in those books that acknowledges that that existence is what they want to throw away. So, yeah, this is a horrible endeavor on their part. I honestly don't see why some group, though, can't go to the landfill, if landfills are the way I've seen landfills, and retrieve these books, you know, because I think that is a possibility. I don't think landfills are that highly secure that you're not allowed to go out there and rummage for things.
Trash picks.
But that would be, you know, not a lot of fun, but it would be interesting. And I do want to clarify one point you made. The vice president is up 4 points in Florida, correct? Not just nationwide.
Yes. Not just nationwide.
Yeah. So that is a big deal. As you and I have talked about privately, number one, the media keeps wanting to say, oh, Kamala Harris is up 4 points, but that's within the margin of error. Well, guess what? The margin of error goes both ways. So, yes, that could mean they're pretty closely tied, but it could also mean she's like 7 points ahead of him. And in Florida, where he lives, where they've registered more Republicans and all that, that's a huge, huge, huge landmark. Anyway, enough of that. We're going to move on to looking back instead of looking forward to that mess. Like I said, I've got two distinguished guests on. I'm going to bring them on at the same time. Martin Lewis is – I'm going to put a word on both these gentlemen that I'm sure they're going to cringe at, so I'm going to say it while they're not on the air, but I think they're both heroes. Martin particularly goes after causes and Amnesty International that are worldwide and really fighting for the unspoken. And Brian Epstein, you know, is a case in point of that. You know, here's somebody who really had enormous impact on our culture, but is anything but a, household name. And Bruce Valanche also, he's lived out and proud for a long, long time. He was gay before it was cool to be gay. And has given a lot of public people the language and the jokes and the persona to help stand for that spirit of being LGBTQ. And with that, I would like to welcome to the show both Martin and Bruce. Welcome,
wow.
Gentlemen.
You didn't
Hello.
Mention my sex tape. I'm an icon with a sex tape. I just have to point that out.
Just like to say, Rob, isn't this normally the point in the show where you say, and I'm sorry, that's all we have time for?
No. We have so much time, although I have a feeling we are going to fill it without any problem. But, when I bring on my guests, I like to say all the flattering stuff up front so they don't shush me while I'm trying to say it while they're on the line.
Being British, one is entirely embarrassed by praise. Of course, I'm entirely deserving of it, but I have to be publicly very embarrassed to be so described.
Well, my DNA comes
from Britain.
I have no
such problem.
So I have to say, I have a fantasy, and it's not about the sex tape, Bruce, but I have this fantasy. Uh-huh. One of our good friends of the show is Julia Scotti, who's a trans comedian. She was on America's Got Title and all that. I have this fantasy of you and she making a sitcom that you play a couple in a trailer park, and you play kind of the Archie Bunker modern character of a MAGA character who ghostwrites tweets for Donald Trump, and she's your activist wife who is a Bernie Sanders fan, and the world around that. So if I was
it's
in Hollywood,
idea.
That's a sitcom I would put out there.
This is coming from a person who's been told he's too gay for logo. So I don't know where we pitch this, but I think it's a fabulous idea.
I think it could be even better if you add in a cute English butler. I think that would just help.
Right. I think that would be fabulous.
It's never heard.
Oh, my God, yes. So, one thing I wanted to ask both of you, because – it is hard to pinpoint either one of you. Any label they put on either one of you is like woefully inadequate. What do you each identify yourselves as professionally?
Bruce, go first.
You mean in terms of identity, you mean sexually or you mean like in the ongoing binary, non-binary world?
Don't get me started on binary, non-binary. I think we've limited all of humanity with that one. But
I'm sure Rob wants to know how you describe yourself in terms of your career, which is so multifaceted.
Well, I mean, I'm a writer, actor, stripper. You name it, you book it, you got it.
There we go.
If you want to know how I drive, I wear several hats. I mean, if I was a milliner, I'd be in doing great business because I wear so many hats. And it used to be traditionally considered a few hundred years ago a good thing to wear different hats, but you were called a Renaissance man or a polymath. But these days, people are expected to focus on just one thing. So I'm so old, I'm not even a Renaissance man. I'm more of a Dark Ages man. And there's no point being a polymath because most people, especially in America, have no idea what it means. So I describe myself as the world's least understated Englishman.
I like that.
Okay, we'll count on that. You know, if you get old enough, you sort of transcend, and they just call you a god. So, you know, we'll just go with that.
Mm-hmm.
So
I can take it.
I wanted to, since I'm kind of doing ADD here, Bruce, one thing that when I saw on your resume that I was like gobsmacked with, which is, and this is going to be a weird one, is that you were actually one of the writers behind Flip Wilson's Geraldine and the Flip Wilson
Yes.
Show. Yeah.
That's true.
Which
so few people
like,
ever noticed that.
Well, I noticed it because I have gone for the past few years, talked about that all over the place because it's a huge example of how American culture could not have cared less about a man in a dress back in those conservative mm-hmm. times with Flip Wilson. And Geraldine was so perfect and out there and you know, shady and campy and all that. And, you know, it didn't disturb anybody. And now, you know, it's like a drag queen, you know, just shows up in a fairy godmother costume and people lose their crap over it.
I don't think a lot of people lose their crap over it, if you could allow me just to inject this.
Oh, sure.
I think a bunch of shrill people who live in an echo chamber of the social media within the bubble of their own world make noise about this. I don't think the general public really gives a shit about that. I just think it's us, it's people we know, but the general public doesn't know them. You know, Geraldine was a funny a character. A man in a dress was just funny, and they'd never seen a black man do it on national television. I always remind people that the most popular couple in the world in the 50s was a Cuban drummer and his white wife.
You know, right.
I mean, nobody carried on about that. I mean, there was more of an issue of her being pregnant on television than there was about the fact that she was Lily White married to a Latin guy. And this is the early 50s. So the general public accepts a lot of stuff. It's always a shrill minority that makes noise about it that doesn't. Now, that's not saying that they don't have a valid point. They don't have a valid point every single time, but they have a valid point that needs to be listened to every single time.
That's so, something that right, you're saying, Bruce, is exactly, in a sense, if I can bring a Beatle connection in here, in the animated film called Yellow Submarine, there were some bad guys, and they were called the Blue Meanies. And what the Blue Meanies represented were all the forces that we had confronted before, but certainly in the 60s, who were mean-spirited, who were not inclusive, who did not celebrate diversity or progress. And that spirit has unfortunately always been amongst the human species, but it seems to be very present again today. And what happens in the Yellow Submarine film is that the Beatles conquer that blue meanie, snide, negative spirit with colorful, bright, positive thoughts, and they see the word no, N-O, put in big letters on a pedestal, and they add the letters K and W, so it becomes no, as in knowledge. That is what, you know, forgive me for tooting the horn of the hippie generation, but we tried in our naivety, we tried to make the world a better place. The Beatles certainly did, and that mean-spirited thing that Bruce has just spoken about is present, and we can only conquer it with love.
Right. Well, to Bruce's point, though, I really do think that what happened was the Blue Meanies went underground. And to me, that is Trump's greatest sin, was he basically opened Pandora's box and gave them permission to emerge and to take over schools and, you know, throw books in trucks and take them to landfills and things like that. But Martin, let's pivot to Bruce Epstein. You
Brian
were
Epstein.
Brian
Epstein.
Bruce Epstein,
I did away with years
Bruce,
ago.
I've got Bruce on my mind. What can I tell you? So, Brian Epstein, who cannot speak for himself. Team, when you first became enamored with the Beatles, take us back there.
I was actually even a little bit younger, 14, when I first got involved working on something Beatles-related. But I was a kid. I was about 10 or 11 when I first heard the Beatles, and there was something revolutionary about them. They were invigorating. The music was just so alive. It conveyed exuberance, a giddy optimism about life. In Britain, everything in the 50s was, you know, in America you got Technicolor and you got color TV. Britain, we weren't even in black and white. We were in gray and grayer. Everything was just dreadfully drab and dull. The Beatles literally took us into 3D Technicolor. Suddenly it was joyous and bright and happy. And they had this optimistic attitude. And we would never, when I first heard that was the feeling I got. And the story about it, and it's too long for your show, but there'll be a lot of it in the TED talk that I give, but the nuts and bolts of it was highly improbable that the Beatles would ever succeed in their own country, let alone America or anywhere else in the world, because they came from a little provincial northern town. It was like coming from Detroit in those days, or Boise, Idaho. It was not a cultural center. And the Beatles were working class kids, and yet they burst forth. They were unstoppable. But they had not been, they'd been knocking around for 4 years, getting nowhere, until Brian Epstein happens upon them. Now, Brian Epstein is a young kid. He tried to be an actor. He went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, failed, wasn't any good at it. He was working in his parents' appliance store, running a little record counter, selling records. And somebody told him about the Beatles. They were playing in a local dive. He went there at lunchtime, and he went there, saw them. And though he was 27 years old, had zero experience of the entertainment industry, had never managed anybody or anything, he took one look and said, these guys are amazing. Not just their music, it was their personality, their spirit. And he decided to manage them. They accepted because they weren't going anywhere as far as they could tell. And he made this prediction, and he wasn't a big braggart type. He just said, they are going to be bigger than Elvis Presley, who at that time was the biggest entertainer in the world. It was an incredibly ludicrous thing to state. It just made no sense. And yet, within the space of 2 years, that had come true, and then he conquered America. And it's an astonishing story. If you wrote it into a screenplay, Bruce and I both know plenty of screenwriters and novelists. If you wrote it into a screenplay or into a novel, the editor or the producer would say, ludicrous, could never happen, implausible, take it out. And yet, Brian Epstein made that happen.
And what is it that you think Brian saw in them that inspired him to make that statement?
It really was their bonhomie on stage, because their music was still rather primitive. It had an energy and an excitement, and they made the audience enjoy it, and that was there. But they had this, if it's interesting, when you watch the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show for the very first time, which happened in February of 1964, I'll repeat an analogy I just made. Even though that show was in black and white, the audience is definitely in black and white, but the Beatles, when you look at them, they're like they're in glowing color. And the reason it was because when most performers were on the Ed Sullivan Show, they all had these plastic showbiz Las Vegas smiles. Oh, we're on television. We must do a plastic smile. The Beatles didn't have that. They just had this natural bonhomie, this natural exuberance from the joy of making music. And that was what conveyed itself first to Brian Epstein, then to the kids in Britain, and then finally to 73 million Americans watching the Ed Sullivan Show, they were different. They weren't manufactured. They were not a confection. They were the real thing. And what came across was their authenticity. And Epstein was the one who saw it. And just to finish this thought, in the talk I give, I'm going to explain how it was that the Beatles became so successful in America in the space of just 45 days. Because on Christmas Day 1963, literally no one in America had ever heard of them. And yet on the February the 9th of 1964, 73 million people tuned in to see them on the Ed Sullivan Show, which at that time used to have a weekly audience of 14 million. So how was it that this complete unknown bunch of kids with weird haircuts playing what was considered American music, rock and roll, how did they go from a zero to the biggest thing in the space of 45 days? And the answer was Brian Epstein. It was what he did. And that's what's such an astonishing story. The Beatles went viral before there was viral.
Right. Yeah, and that is one of the things that I love looking at your personal background is, you know, like I was talking about, you know, kind of the titles before, of, you know, what you would call yourself or whatever. But, you know, marketing and that kind of mindset is part of, I think, what you have actually contributed, which no one ever thanks you for. No, people thank you for what you've written and what you've produced and the songs you sang, but they never thank you for how well you marketed something. So I'm...
Well, that's partly true, but in a sense, you're not expected to be in the limelight. When you do publicity or marketing, and both of those were things I did for a long time and still do occasionally, I was mentored by another person from the Beatles circle, a chap called Derek Taylor, who was their publicist, and he was a genius at publicity, absolutely, obviously, and he worked very closely with Brian Epstein. And he told me, Martin, your job is not to be the story. When you do publicity or marketing, you're invisible. Your job is to, you know, like when you say the best actors, they don't draw attention to the fact that they're acting. You don't even know they're acting because you don't draw attention to it. So when you do publicity and marketing, it is an unsung role because your job is to make the client or the film or the book or the artist, the musician, make that person successful. So, yeah, you take the quiet satisfaction you've done it. But you're right, there aren't many garlands thrown about, but that's okay. The reward is seeing the work. Really, when you see the success and when you see people enjoy something that, and you know you've drawn their attention to it, that is its reward. That and the $1 million, which nobody ever gives me.
Right. Well, I'm a renegade, so I'm going to say the silent part out loud. Thank you for doing all that. Mm-hmm. One of the things you have talked about is comparing Brian Epstein to Alan Turing, who was the subject of the film the Imitation Game, but most importantly, he was by many credited to be the father of modern computing, and even more than that, he quite arguably is the person that allowed the Allies to win World War II, and yet he had a hugely tragic end. Because he was gay and because he was marginalized and arrested and chemically castrated and then ended up ending his life. Tell us about how Brian's story kind of lines up with that.
I will, and I'll say first of all that when I first mentioned that analogy to my dear, dear friend Bruce, we've been friends for 40 years and more, Bruce said, Martin, come on, Alan Turing was chemically castrated, Brian didn't suffer that, and Bruce is absolutely right, he didn't suffer
That's
in
true.
That same way. But what I meant by that analogy is that Alan Turing was unbelievably heroic in what he did, and what happened to him, the torture that he went through, the shame he felt, was absolutely appalling, and it was indicative of the era in which Alan lived, in which they were so intolerant that he could not be himself, he could not express himself, he couldn't love who he wanted to love. and was made to feel shame and ultimately tormented to the point of his death. Brian Epstein went through something similar, not as drastic, but Brian Epstein brought enormous joy into the world because of what he did by bringing us the Beatles. And in today's world, anybody who did what Brian Epstein did had made somebody so successful would be toast of the town, would be enjoying life, would be happy, and really able to be celebrating what he'd done. But Brian Epstein was gay at a time, A, when that word wasn't used, they used really unkind words. I remember hearing those words all the time when I was growing up. And so he was ashamed and fearful that if it ever became public, that it would besmirch the Beatles, who he adored as people. So he was tormented, and his personal life was always furtive and secretive. He couldn't be open. And eventually he was drowning in drinks and barbiturates. His life ended accidentally. He had an accidental overdose. But this was a man who was unhappy. He should have been the happiest man in the world, and he wasn't. He was miserable. So it's not as drastic as Alan Turing, but it's similar in that he was a victim of an intolerant world. In 1967, if you were found to have committed, as it was thought, a homosexual act, you went to prison in England. You went to prison. And it was that barbaric world, just as Alan Turing suffered that barbaric monstrosity of attitude, Brian Epstein and millions of others were suffering that way. And as if that wasn't bad enough, he wasn't just gay, he was also Jewish. And that was not a picnic either in Britain. So two minorities for the price of one. So, you know, that's why I would say it was a pretty tough business being Brian Epstein in the 60s.
No, it's absolutely. And it is kind of appalling, but it is fascinating and intriguing how gay people in society both operated. The one thing that both of your careers impresses upon me is how really our culture, and I was alluding to this at the top of the show, our culture just wouldn't be what it is in any way, shape, or form without gay influence. And you guys have been seeing it more from behind the scenes. In fact, you've actually architected it more from behind the scenes actively. What are your thoughts on, just open it up to, gay influence on American culture?
Bruce, you should take that.
I missed the last part of it.
What is your thought on the complete integration and influence of gay thought process, intuitiveness, creativity on American culture, the beginning?
Well, I think we get the artistic gene, a lot of us. I think that puts us in the position where we can do that, where it's not like we have a political agenda to do that. It's that this is who we are, and it works. That way of looking at the world works. It's kind of like, why do they perform Oscar Wilde plays still? Why is he such an influential writer when he died in 1900? Because he had that thing that we now interpret as the gay gene in his work. And he had a way of looking at things which was essentially modern and has translated very well into our culture, but it's being done by people who have that same impetus. I mean, I think it's a real kind of wowser generalization, but yeah, we are wildly influential. I mean, I'm always afraid to talk about this stuff because it sounds to me like the Jews control banking, the Jews control Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm a Jew and I'm gay, so who needs this extra added attraction? It's just, you know, and now you're going to blame us for culture? What? So, but yes, of course it's there.
It's interesting that because I talk again about the 60s and what there was that, there's two really long words that I can barely pronounce and certainly can't spell, but they're interesting words. One is Apollonian, meaning the support of the god Apollo, which is uplifting, positive, towards the stars. And the other one is Dionysian, from Dionysus, which is negative, wanting to roll in the gutter with all the negative thoughts. The Beatles and a lot of other artists of the 1960s were Apollonian. They strove to make the world a better place. And that happened in so much in the writer Joe Orton, who wrote Loot, and who wrote the third screenplay for the Beatles film that was never produced. Joe Orton was the subject of a movie called Prick Up Your Ears, written by Alan Bennett. There was a vast cultural renaissance in the 60s, and it came from gays, it came from Jews, it came from minorities, it came from black artists, it came from all the people who weren't white. Nothing wrong with white people. I'm white myself. But the people who weren't white and who weren't straight were being ignored. And then suddenly in the 60s, there was this huge uprising. And here's an interesting thing, which my gay friends don't know, but before the word gay was rightly given, and so that there was a nice word to describe being gay rather than all those dreadful epithets that were used, the Beatles were once described as gay. And here in the newspaper that is the most influential newspaper in Britain, The Times, we British are so arrogant, it's not the London Times or the UK Times, it's just The Times, you know, The Times. So that's the most important paper in Britain. And The Times did a review of the Sgt. Pepper album when it came out in June 1967. And here's the headline. The Beatles revive hopes of progress in pop music with their gay new LP. That was the headline, because gay meant bright and exuberant and positive.
Right.
And of course, then now afterwards, once gay got another meaning, unfortunately, there was all that kind of sniggering, that negative, the blue meanies who would snigger and make snide jokes. Oh, gay, he, the gay divorcee, he. Whereas gay was always a positive word. So it angered me that gay became a negative to some people, those blue meanie types.
Oh yeah, well the blue meanies hate the fact that gay became gay, and you know, because they were back on the gay apparel times, and
right. They're
pissed off that we took the rainbow, you know, like they had claim over the rainbow, and it's like no you don't. But going back to the thing with Bruce, there's a lot of it where I feel like you being you and doing what you did. You know, you just were expressing your point of view, and I really think beyond the gay gene, it's also, at least from my perspective, because when we were little children and we were told how the world was and who we were supposed to love and who we were supposed to think was attractive and everything else, inside us was something that went, no, that doesn't work. And yeah. I think it's that even though it may have been around that impulse, it also, to me, for a lot of gay people and lesbian people and trans people, put us in a place of, let's look at everything differently. Let's not, you know, they told us this was the way it was, and we don't think it is. So therefore, maybe other things aren't the way we think they're, or the way they are telling us they are. And I loved your example of Lucy and Ricky Ricardo or Desi Arnaz, because ironically, and I was just thinking about this when you were talking about it, so we had that sitcom that was on the air because an actress wanted to work with her husband. And that's how that happened. It wasn't like anybody trying to do a revolution. But then 10 years later, in 67, interracial marriage became legal. You know, it's like we have people living their natural lives and getting out there and expressing it, and it's like a pebble that ripples out and then affects changes beyond what we intended necessarily
right.
To influence. So it's like I still think everything you've done is heroic and important, even though you think you were just showing up and writing your best joke. And, you know, so kudos.
Well, so let me ask you a question. When I was coming up, we didn't want to get married. We didn't want to have children, and we didn't want to serve in the military. Now we clamor for all three. What's that about?
Well,
we were the outlaws.
Two ironies.
We were looking.
Yeah,
we were so much of what informed our culture was we were on the outside looking in. Now we're inside.
You were the dogs that caught the car. I mean, listen, one of the other things...
Is somebody going to tell Mayor Pete that his marriage is illegal? Is that going to happen with the Supreme Court? What up?
Yeah.
It is. Listen, when they talk about Project 2025, I think that there is clearly a typo there, because what they're talking about is Project 1825. They're simply wanting to go back 200 years is what's happening there. And we're going into politics, and we should, because these matters are political, cultural, and social matters. One of the things, the reasons I got involved with Amnesty International initially, and this is where entertainers have such a role to play, and Bruce and all the folks that he's worked with over the years have been so inspirational, is in an ideal world, we wouldn't put entertainers on a pedestal and say that their opinions are of greater value than anyone else's. But that's not the real world. The fact is that people look to their heroes, their cultural or sporting heroes, and say, gee, if, you know, Taylor Swift thinks this way or Bruce Springsteen thinks that way, then maybe that'll influence them. And that's what we did with Amnesty International. We got together a bunch of people, Monty Python and Pete Townsend and Sting and folks like that, and we simply drew attention to human rights. And the founder of Amnesty had a lovely phrase, which I think actually goes back probably 400 or 500 years, but it had passed long. But the way he expressed it was, it is better in the darkness, it is better, rather than to curse the darkness, light a candle. Light a candle
right.
rather than curse the darkness. And the symbol of Amnesty became the
candle. I hope he doesn't claim
candle.
That for himself.
No. Yeah. Because it was from 300 or 400 years before.
Good.
Yeah. But, although as much as lighting a candle is important, I do want to answer Bruce's question, though, because I think part of it, and not everything, but part of it was, and I'll speak this from me growing up, young and impressionable, secretly gay on the inside, was when they came out and went, because they didn't want us to do any of those things. It's not just, you know, that we couldn't. It was like, you know, you cannot serve in the military. If you say you're gay, boom, you're automatic out.
Right.
You know, it's like, you can't get married. And that was like held in our face. So part of me, and, you know, I desired to have a family and all that. That was there. But when they said I couldn't, it was like, oh fuck no. You think I can't? Oh, you just watch me. You know? So I think there's a little bit of like, it's a little bit like, hell, you're going to limit us. I mean, that's part of the thing that I was talking about before about, you know, when they didn't tell us the truth when we were little and we got that there was another truth outside of what we were told, it was like, we have to go create it on our own. And, you know, it's even to the point in the culture now where people create their own chosen families when they've been rejected by the birth families and, you know, that type of thing. I think there's a righteous anger that has allowed us to be as diverse as we really are.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right there. And of all the Beatles, the one who was the most political was John Lennon. And he became, and it didn't win him friends. There were a lot of people who said, you know, just stay being the quiet, cute Beatle with the little haircut and, you know, and just make the happy-go-lucky pop songs. John Lennon became influenced by what he saw around him, and Yoko Ono helped galvanize that, but it was happening before then. He listened to Bob Dylan, and he started to read and started to understand what was going on in the world, and he became a very vocal critic. I always thought that it was astonishing that John Lennon was one frightened the most powerful man in the world in 1972 was Richard Nixon, then President of the United States. And mm-hmm. Richard Nixon, encouraged by Strom Thurmond, a reactionary Republican senator, tried to get John Lennon deported because he was frightened that John Lennon was going to lead peaceful young people in campaigning against the Vietnam War and against Richard Nixon's re-election in 72. So he tried to deport him. And I thought, wow, what a blow for artists. What a great thing that an mm-hmm. artist can induce fear in the most powerful man in the world. And what's he frightened of? Mm-hmm. The power of words, the power of music, the power of love. And so ultimately, united, we still have that power. We can defeat the Blue Meanies because laughter and music and love and smiles and thought will always defeat if we are united. It really has that
exactly.
impact.
Yeah,
can
absolutely.
I just address what I thought was a very eloquent statement about what changed in the gay community from my generation to your generation was that we were happy to live a limited life if they left us alone. As
right.
things happened to us, anti-gay legislation and then AIDS, the revolutionary spirit developed among both generations, and the idea of living a full life became desirable. Well, it's difficult to describe to people who weren't there how cozy it was to be living a secret society with codes and with outlaw behavior and stuff like that. And you can see it in old movies when, you know, the wink that they give each other. And all that kind of stuff. It was a hardship for people who, like Alan Turing, and maybe like Brian Epstein, who seemed to be surrounded by artistic people who allowed him to be who he was. But it wasn't the worst world to live in, and it took people getting angry eventually about not wanting to live a limited life that caused that to happen. Now I don't know what we do with it now that we've got it, but because when you're not living in the mainstream, you kind of look upon as an oddball. But there you go.
I think that is absolutely golden what you just said, because it's not just true of that generational shift. It's also like people looking back in the 90s. Like I'll look at mm-hmm. you know Sex and the City shows and Friends and everything else. And a lot of the humor then around gay people doesn't carry now, where back
right.
then Friends was like the best friends we had. You know, it's like Friends was like this amazingly gay friendly show that, you know, it's like
mm-hmm.
because the jokes on it were more about the guys being afraid of being gay than it was making
right.
fun of gay people. And, you know, that at that point, that was improvement. And to your point, totally comfortable with it. It wasn't like, you know, now where, you know, the sensitivities have gotten so, you know, trigger happy on
right.
like, oh my God, you know. So
yeah.
it is.
The other thing about Friends
was
that it endorsed the idea that your friends are your real family. There's so many people
right.
whose families rejected them, and especially when they would introduce members of the friends' families, and they were all so bizarre. And you understood why they weren't that close to any of them.
That's
very true. Rob, if I may be so shameless as to plug this event that's coming up.
Shamelessly turn it to you to do that. So go for
it. Thank you. And ultimately, listen, one of my things, and I did this event a few years ago during San Francisco Gay Pride Week, there was a concert, it was a glorious concert, of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus singing Beatles songs. And Alan Cumming was the MC, and it was designed to celebrate Brian Epstein. And I was so thrilled because I thought, great, the gay community should be proud that without Brian Epstein, without this gay man, there'd be no Beatles. No one would have heard of them. And in a time when gay and LGBT people are under pressure and still getting this negativity from the Blue Meanies, let you stand up and say, you know what, you like the Beatles music, well, guess what, if it hadn't been for this gay Jewish guy, you wouldn't have had the Beatles. I think the gay community, the Jewish community, should all be taking that position. When I got up on stage, Alan invited me to say a few words about Brian Epstein and explain who he was, I was greeted, I tried to explain who he was, and I said, look, Brian Epstein, I identified with him because he was English, I was English, he was Jewish, I was Jewish, he was gay, and I paused a beat, taught by Bruce how to have good timing. I said, well, I wasn't cute enough to be gay. I then was rewarded with a lot of wolf whistles, and Alan Cumming told me to stop being so shameless and get off the bloody stage. What it did bring to me was that I do encourage the LGBTQ community to embrace Brian Epstein and talk about him to friends, to people who don't know that a gay man, a tortured gay man, was the man behind the Beatles. And there's a website page, and the URL is so short that anyone can remember it. It's information about this event, it is PRS, as in Peter Robert Smith, but actually that stands for Philosophical Research Society, so PRS.org/Beatles. That's it, PRS.org Beatles. And that's where you will find all the information, tickets, the whole works.
And the event is August 23rd. And do you know how much the tickets cost?
Yes, because I'm the headline, it's $10. I think they were going to try and make them $5, but the digital machines didn't go that low of ticket price. But they didn't think they could charge for Martin Lewis headlining, $10 was the max.
No, definitely worth it. And the title is The Greatest Beatles Story Never Told, The Untold Tale of How the Beatles Beguiled America. So, fascinating thing. And mm-hmm. I think it's going to be great. Is it going to be videoed, Martin?
It's not going to be live streamed, and I think they may have it available afterwards on their website. I haven't checked that. And as if it wasn't enough, I'm also adding a little bit of catnip to entice folks along. I'm going to be giving the world premiere of a never-before-heard curio from the 1967 Sgt. Pepper sessions, the world premiere of something that no one's ever heard before. So if you're a real dedicated Beatle fan, that's tempting.
That's awesome. I want to thank you both. Actually, I want to thank you both for being who you are, because I truly do think you each are heroes, and your work, you have propelled so many people forward to the front lines and been behind the scenes and are kind of like the true puppet masters. And you know, as cringe as that sounds, That's how I see you. And
I like you. I like you. It appeals to my sinister side.
Cool. And that's all the time we have today. So I want to thank you for being on with me today. Great conversation for our listeners. We'll be back next week with yet another conversation. Hope you tune in. Thank Brody Levesque for his work on the show. And, yeah, that is it for us for this week. And gentlemen, again, thank you.
Well, it was a great pleasure, especially to be on with my dear friend Bruce.
Wonderful. Yeah. It was.
You guys are awesome.
It was a lot of fun.
And that is
and
it for
if
us
I see Bruce Epstein,
today.
I will certainly say hello.
Definitely.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.